Hello and welcome once more to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker 106.7 FM, broadcasting out of Wilmington, North Carolina. It is the 18th of January in the year 2020. I am Yael Ososki from Consumer Choice Center, and I'm joined as always by my co-host and colleague, Mr. David Clement. David, how are you, my man?
I'm doing pretty well. Looking forward to our second episode of what will be many. And getting down to the brass tacks about what's going on both in the U.S. And internationally. Definitely exciting times.
Well, I don't want to pay any brass taxes, which is why I pay attention and listen to Consumer Choice Radio. We're at consumerchoiceradio.com. You can actually listen to our program, not just here on the live stream on the radio, but also online. You can listen to the podcast. We are in all the podcast stores on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Overcast. You can just find our RSS feed on consumerchoiceradio.com. Everything is there, and the show notes as well. So it's been a crazy week, David. A lot of different things happening, and probably top of mind for many is the debates, and we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. First thing that we want to get to is we have a great interview lined up with Mr. Tim Andrews. Tim is himself an Aussie, also an American citizen, actually. So he splits his time between the United States and Australia, and we figured we'd give our listeners a little bit of a report on what is happening with the bushfires in Australia. And now we're speaking with Tim Andrews. Tim is the executive director at the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, and he is himself a founder of the Australian Taxpayers Alliance as well. He's a global man who knows about politics and every single ream of the global empire. And it's a pleasure to talk to you, Tim. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Of course, and Tim's coming to us from Washington, D.C. here on the Big Talker FM, and we wanted to get him on because he does have very particular knowledge. He's someone who is very, very knowledgeable about everything that's been happening down under. As many of us were reining in the new year, we were seeing the video reports, and we've been able to read many stories and see a lot of clips about the bushfires and how crazy the bushfires have gotten, just how many animals were killed, how much land was destroyed. There was so much about that. And while we were reading a lot and seeing a lot of images, there were a lot of stories that were being generated around this, specifically around what is the role of government in terms of putting out these fires, what caused these fires, what can people do to protect against these fires in the future, what about the environment? There's so many questions, Tim, so I just wanted to get kind of your first take. If you could explain to our listeners here, what really was the catalyst of this? What evolved from it, and what is now the kind of impact that this is going to have in Australia for the next few months to come?
Absolutely. So, as you say, these truly have been horrific fires. I mean, it reached a stage where in the centre of downtown Sydney, office buildings were being evacuated because the smoke was so thick. It was said it was setting off smoke detectors in major office buildings, despite the fires being over 100 kilometres away. We saw just a few days ago at the Australian Open in tennis in Melbourne. Games couldn't be completed because players were getting sick from the smoke. You've seen hundreds of millions of animals perish, lives being lost. A large part of the country was in flames. These aren't the worst fires in terms of the loss of human lives. And there were fires, the Black Friday fires about 20 years ago in Melbourne, which claimed close to 200 lives. So fortunately, it hasn't reached that level of human cost, but they are truly horrific fires. The problem is, and fortunately, by the way, there was a lot of rain overnight, so a lot of these fires are finally starting to get put out. The sad thing is that a lot of people have tried to use these fires to further a political agenda and to try and blame simplistic things for the cause, and to use this to push a particular narrative. You've seen this a lot internationally, where this was seen, against most of the scientific evidence, solely caused by climate change. Domestically in Australia, you've seen also a lot of debate about the role of climate change, the role of government policy from one side of politics. But on the other side, you've seen everything from crazy conspiracy theories that, been circulating the internet about, this was all arson caused by environmentalists wanting to cause it, which is an same conspiracy theory.
Yeah, actually, when
you've
I...
You've seen Islamic terrorism as a conspiracy theory. I've seen one conspiracy theory that they were all deliberately set to allow for a high-speed rail corridor to be built in Australia. So you need to sort of look at this carefully. I mean, bear in mind, arson was a contributing factor to a lot of the fines, but it wasn't as big an issue as a lot of people are making it out to be. You've seen a lot of people saying, oh, don't need to worry about it, it was all arson. It's not anything else. 200 people were arrested for fire-related offences. That's not really an accurate number because that included things like, you know, completely unrelated to the fires, fire-related offences. I mean, yes, arson was a factor, but it wasn't the reason why the fires are so bad.
One thing that I saw, Tim, by the way, that I thought was incredibly interesting is, much like the United States, there seemed to be a debate about what the role of government was in stopping these fires and preventing them. And there's a lot about federalism, you know, how much should the states do and how much should the federal government do? Could you explain to us a little bit about that and kind of why that led to some fallout?
Sure. So there are two separate issues here. The first issue is the role of preventing fires in the first place, which is, I think, the main issue that I want to discuss with you. And there's the issue of the response, because state governments are primarily responsible for fire management. But as with most things, there's a natural disaster, people don't necessarily understand the role of state versus federal governments. People expect the government needs to do something. And so the federal government gets the blame for things that were state government responsibilities. Now, I think from an optics perspective, the federal government completely mismanaged the handling, but that was an optics perspective rather than an actual on-the-ground perspective, reality. But this does present a challenge for people who believe in federalism, because it's hard when you have natural disasters to try and explain the difficulty, you know, the delineation between federal and state responsibilities when people just want the government needs to do something. And they usually just blame the centre. The bigger issue in terms of the role of government, though, is to do with hazard reduction burning and what led to these fires being so bad in the first place. Now, I'm not going to offer this as a completely simplistic answer. This was an unusually very hot, very dry summer. But you've seen after every major fire in Australia, such as the ones in the early night in 92, such as the ones in the late 90s, such as the bushfires that I was caught into about 20 years ago, which was a horrific experience. Like, these things are scary. But every government inquiry has come out and said, we need to increase hazard reduction burns. So these are the burns that you do before fires to try and clear out all the back growth in the area so that there's less things to burn and then don't get as hot as they should be.
And Tim, really, really quick here, that would be the responsibility, and correct me if I'm wrong, but just so that our listeners know, that would be the responsibility of state governments, not of the federal government. Okay, great.
And it gets a little bit more tricky here because it's also a responsibility of local governments to approve it in some cases or to work in concert. And you've seen cases where essentially NIMBYism of people on the ground saying, well, we don't want this in our area. We like having more diverse bushlands, so don't have hazard reduction burns in our area. So you do sort of have a bit of it, and there were in an area that recently burned down, near an area that burned down in Victoria, you had protests, literally trying to blockade firefighters trying to do hazard reduction burns by the environmentalists in the local area, and ended up not doing them because they wanted to protect their little area. So there is a sort of a bit of a problem with localism in that space where people want hazard reduction burning, just not in their area. But yes, it is primarily a state government responsibility, and there has been generally a view that elements of the environmental movement have pushed that hazard reduction burns hurt biodiversity, we need to do them as little as possible, and so you have this build-up of old wood and this buildup of leaves and things on the ground, you don't have that level of hazard reduction burning. Often, you know, with a stated purpose of protecting biodiversity, but then every 10 years you have these huge fires that just destroy everything. And as I said, you've seen numerous government inquiries recommend that hazard reduction burns be increased, and you've seen a failure to do this. And you've seen, and you can read all of the submissions by a lot of environmental groups opposing this. So government, the government has come out and said, well, in most areas we've reached our, this isn't, we're not to blame, we reached our hazard reduction burning quota for the year. But when the quota was set so low, that's the problem. And so this has become a concerted political debate in Australia between environmentalists, activists who say it's all about climate change, and people on the other who say, well, no, you've, because of environmental reasons, we've not taken the actions that would have reduced the severity of these burns in the first place. Yeah, of these fires in the first place.
Definitely. There's already a process in place, these controlled burns, to stop these major fires. And this sprued up in the United States as well, in California, when we had large wildfires. Of course, President Trump could not help himself from inserting himself into the debate and talked about how the controlled burns that have been working for years in places like Finland have actually been a success. And then California, they haven't been doing enough. They haven't been clearing the brush. So definitely a lot there. I'm wondering, Tim, when it comes to the larger debate about climate change, there's a lot of things that will be happening over the next couple of weeks. We'll be in Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum. Climate change is big on the agenda. Greta Thunberg will be there and will be speaking about this. And no doubt, the Australian bushfires will be top of mind for a lot of people, and it'll be evoked as just the latest crisis of climate change. What would you respond to the people who would like to use the example of the Australian bushfires in the kind of global meta-narrative about climate change and what human beings and governments need to do to tackle that going forward?
So I think it's important to put this in a context that Australia has a history of fires such as this. I mean, there were fires of this magnitude 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago. So this does need to be put in its correct historical context, that Australia is naturally a hot, flammable place. Now, is this a particularly hot and dry summer? Yes. Does climate change maybe have something to do with it being slightly warmer this year by half a degree than previous? Yes. Can you blame climate change for these fires? I think the clear objective evidence is no. But secondly, even if you accept that climate change is a major role, the question is the appropriate policy responses. And this is where the argument that, well, if we tax everyone more, we tax consumers and households more, then we'll stop fires, is simply ludicrous. There is no carbon reduction policy out there that would have prevented these fires. I mean, first of all, from an Australian perspective, Australia, which produces 1% of the world's emissions, we could shut down every single industry, shut down every power plant, revert to the dark ages, and it still wouldn't have made a shred of difference. So I think sensible policy about climate change, if you believe in it, that it's a contributing factor, should be about emergence of new technologies, which is done through unshackling the power of innovation and the free market, rather than just trying to hit consumers and hurt households with a tax that won't have any impact whatsoever. Like, there is no evidence whatsoever. You can't even make a credible argument that any single plan for decarbonisation through trading schemes, carbon taxes, etc., would have any impact whatsoever. There is no argument about that you can credibly make for that.
And I mean, on top of that, I believe it was just New Zealand who published a report. They actually costed out what it would be for New Zealand to go carbon neutral, and to go carbon neutral by 2050 would cost approximately 16% of their GDP as it currently stands. So just completely cutting off a significant portion of economic activity and prosperity and well-being. And so when we talk about decarbonizing particular countries, I mean, obviously Australia going to carbon neutral tomorrow isn't going to stop these fires.
No, absolutely. And I think that one of the problems is the proponents of these sort of policies, which are these sort of simplistic hammer, everyone with a carbon tax policies, they don't look at the cost of these policies as they apply to humans. They don't look at, I mean, Australia already has some of the highest energy prices in the world, which leads to people not being able to, especially retired persons. I know people, I've spoken to people who can't afford to have air conditioning in summer or heating in winter because the power cost is too much, to the point that I actually know people who have spoken to people who can't afford to run their refrigerator because the power energy costs are so high. Mm-hmm. I mean, this leads to suffering. This leads to health problems in terms of heating and cooling in high pressure. And I mean, these are significant costs that this sledgehammer approach, which again, won't actually make that much of a difference, if any difference, won't address. So as you say, we need a more nuanced and sophisticated understanding. And I think the best way of doing it is, A, looking at, and look, I think that, you know, the climate is warming, humans have something to do with it, but the best solution is looking at how to adapt with better government policies in terms of managing these things. I don't generally like government, big government programs, but I mean, for things like that, fire reduction and things, government has a role to play. So it's how to better manage them. Looking at new technologies, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff that's been done on geo-locking or whatever the term for carbon technologies, other new technologies that are being developed. And what's the best way? Like every environmental problem that's ever been posited over the last, you know, how many years, it's always been new technologies that have come from the free market. Not government picking and choosing winners, but free market developing new technologies that are cleaner, that are more efficient. Mm-hmm. That this is why the Soviet bloc was so terrible environmentally, whereas Europe and the, you know, and the West, you know, the United States and SCO was much better economic environmentally through the last century. This is why all of the you know, the peak oil, peak copper, we're going to run out of all these resources. The Malthusian arguments, they've all been proven wrong because technology adapts and you know, human innovation flourishes. And the problem is that a lot of these policies that the government trying to put into place ends up shackling the market. You try and pick and choose winners. You don't necessarily get the right ones. And you're going to have worse outcomes environmentally in the long term. And you're going to hurt a lot of businesses. You're going to hurt a lot of families in the meantime.
Well, we've got great insight on that, all of what's going on down under. So thanks so much to Tim Andrews. Tim is the founder of the Australian Taxpayers Alliance and executive director of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Tim, where could our listeners find you all over the internet?
So you can look up the Australian Taxpayers Alliance online at taxpayers.org.au. And there's a lot of information and reports that the Australian Taxpayers Alliance has written on energy policy solutions, how you can actually have a better energy policy in Australia. And things such as, you know, the role of nuclear technology as being, which is currently banned. It's illegal to have nuclear power plants in Australia. So the role that plays is an interesting one in other technologies. And for the people in the United States, protectingtaxpayers.org is the website. You can find also social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
All right. Thanks so much, Tim. I hope everyone will be pointed over to that. You're listening to the Big Talker FM 106.7. It's a great day, David. It's a great day because it was a perfect day today to listen to the debate. Did you listen to the debate, the Democratic debates, by any chance, David?
I did, and before we go into what some of the candidates say, can we just take a moment to reflect about how atrocious CNN was? That was probably the worst moderation I've seen at a debate in my entire life. And I mean, and I'm no Bernie Sanders fan, so I'm not coming from this from any type of bias. But the way that they treated Bernie Sanders, it was atrocious in terms of journalistic integrity.
So if you have if you've been under a rock, what happened with the CNN debate is there was a story that appeared on CNN some hours prior that apparently Bernie Sanders had said to Elizabeth Warren in a private meeting with no other witnesses that he never thought a woman could be elected president. Which led to the story online with a lot of unnamed sources and was eventually tossed up as a question during the debate. Bernie Sanders tossed it down and said, no, I did not say this. And then essentially the question to be asked to Senator Warren is, why do you think he said this?
Yeah, it was wild.
It is a perfect setup. There's a very, very good article by Matt Taibbi on that at Rolling Stone. It's just it was a setup. It was a, you know, typical let's tee the ball up and allow someone to hit it out of the park. You already heard they have the stories lined up. They have the headlines. I mean, this is unfortunate because there's a lot of important issues that we should be talking about other than this, right?
Of course. And if he says he didn't say it, the follow-up question shouldn't be to Elizabeth Warren asking, so how did you feel when he said that? I mean, he just said that he didn't say it. The follow-up question would be, well, obviously there's a disagreement between you two. You should figure out whether he actually said it, because one of you is lying, and maybe try and get to the bottom of that. But rather than doing that, they just continued the line of questioning as if it was obvious that he had said that a woman couldn't be president. And so, I mean, it just you could see the preconceived notions from a mile away. And what a disservice to the American voter, regardless of whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent. What a disservice to the American voter, because people genuinely watch these debates to understand what the policy positions are, who they're maybe going to vote for in the primary, who Donald Trump will ultimately go up against, and they're left with this awkward exchange between the moderator and Bernie Sanders, and follow-up questions that completely ignore his answer, and then discussions about something that he vehemently declines he ever said, and all of that time spent on those questions eats into time talking about policy. And I think the American people deserve a little better from their newscasters.
It's pretty unfortunate. And this is only the latest of these cases. This happens practically every month, practically every week. Most of the time we're not as, if I can use the term, woke to it. But the thing with the media kind of coming up with stories and not having sources, I mean, this is just normal in the political season. This is not the time for good journalism. Conversely, this is when journalists and media outlets actually make the most amount of money because a lot of people are advertising. Maybe that gives you an idea as to why many traditional media outlets hate Facebook and hate online social media companies, because all the ad revenue is going there. But that's another point. But yes, as you mentioned, David, there were not times that there were the headlines about policy, unfortunately. Now, we at Consumer Choice Radio did put together clips because, hey, it's important to talk about these ideas. If these are the people who are going to be leading the country, or at least leading the charge for the Democratic Party, it's important to discuss it. Since Bernie Sanders did get burned pretty badly by CNN, I figured, hey, let's start off with him. Let's get some clips, and let's listen to what Senator Sanders believes about trade. There's talks of a trade deal that's been cooked up with China, between Trump and China. That would be kind of the first large agreement between the United States and China that would allow freer trade, that would lower tariffs, and allow people to buy and sell more freely. Sounds like a win-win, but of course not to Senator Sanders.
It is not so easy to put together new trade legislation. If this is passed, I think it will set us back a number of years. Senator Warren is right in saying we need to bring the stakeholders to the table. It is the family farmers here in Iowa and in Vermont and around the country. That is the environmental community. That is the workers. Bottom line here is I am sick and tired of trade agreements negotiated by the CEOs of large corporations.
Senator Klobuchar, I'd like to bring
you in. I'm sick and tired. Now, they kind of mixed up a few topics here, because there was the United States-Canada-Mexico Free Trade Agreement, and then there's this new trade deal with China. So there was kind of mixing it up, but you kind of got the idea there, right? You have the Bernie Sanders idea that it's a conspiracy, that you have the large CEOs that are just negotiating these deals, and this only hurts the little people. There's so much to get into that. You know, obviously, the trade deals that we have up are not the ideal trade deals. This is not what, President David Clement or Prime Minister Yael Osowski or anyone else. By the way, I'd be the Prime Minister of Mexico. But there's not many, there aren't many of these trade deals that we would wholeheartedly endorse and say they're the best thing ever. But, this is the best measure that we have for getting global free trade in the 21st century.
And what I don't think the progressive side of the Democratic Party truly understands is the sheer size and scope and importance of these trade deals. And so if we look at some of the old data in regards to the U.S. And its trade relationship with Canada, so NAFTA and this new agreement, more trade crosses the bridge at Detroit, the Ambassador Bridge between Windsor and Detroit. More trade crosses that bridge in a week than goes from the United States to Japan in a year. And so when we talk about ripping up trade deals, when we talk about not ratifying trade deals, you talk about putting a wrench in the livelihoods of millions and millions of Americans whose jobs rely on access to foreign markets and access to foreign consumers. And then the flip side of that is millions and millions of American consumers who on an ordinary day purchase a variety of goods that are created or sourced from people all over the world. And that can be everything from something you buy at the grocery store, let's say it's food, it can be household appliances, and it can be things that you generally enjoy like wine. And so when you have these Democratic contenders beating the anti-trade drum, it's so necessary for someone to raise their hand and say, hold on a second, trade is a win-win scenario. We are trading with people from around the world to get goods and services that we otherwise can't get at better prices. It increases competition. The American consumer is empowered. That's a positive. So I'd love to certainly see a little more of that.
Yeah,
come through.
And there's a couple of articles that we have linked here in the show notes at consumerchoiceradio.com on trade. There's one, actually it was a study that was done. This article is in the New York Times that mm-hmm. basically showed American consumers, not China, are the ones that have been paying for Trump's tariffs. And then there's another one about the wine industry. The wine industry mm-hmm. itself is just totally scared about the tariffs with the European Union and what's going to happen to a lot of American jobs and businesses. I mean, that's kind of the problem that you have when you start talking about renegotiating trade deals, which seems to be what we do all the time, is that you're really making it hard for people to forecast what they're supposed to do in the future. As you mentioned before, if people are not able to trade over this border, if they don't know what the rules are going to be, if they're going to be limited in the things that they can sell or buy, that changes mm-hmm. a lot. And that's not really at anyone's benefit. But I will say, David, there was someone who was very agreeable and loves trade. And we heard him during the debate. Would you believe it was good old Uncle Joe? Let's listen to
it. No trade agreement signed in my administration without environmentalist and labor at the table. And there will be no trade agreement until we invest more in American workers. We should be putting our money and our effort and our time in preparing America workers to compete in the 21st century on the high-tech side, dealing with all artificial intelligence. We should be focusing on equipping American workers to do that. And by the way, the idea, I don't know that there's any trade agreement that the senator would ever think made any sense. Oh. But the problem is that 95% of the customers are out there. So we better figure out how we begin to write the rules of the road, not China.
Oh, that was good. That was good. I don't know if Bernie would be for any trade deal. I mean, this is good. This is the moderate versus the liberal wing of the Democratic parties, and they're debating trade. And I wish Joe Biden wouldn't have to put all these qualifiers up before saying that he supports free trade.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems as if for anything that you stake a claim or try to put out your position on, there's so many qualifiers now. I mean, this is not a straight shooter, Joe.
No. I mean, it is very nice and definitely refreshing to hear him at least defend the concept of trade. I think he rightfully points out that there isn't a trade deal that Bernie Sanders would ever support. It's just not in his brand.
It's not in my DNA to support that, David.
Yeah, exactly. He has a fundamentally false view of how trade works. But when it comes to Joe and it comes to the Obama record, yes, they were relatively pro-trade in regards to, like, if you compare them to the Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warrens. But some of the data from the Obama era on trade is actually quite problematic. So you look at something like Obama tariffs on China. I think the most recent data showed that for every job saved by Obama's tariffs on China, it cost $1 million. Wow. In additional costs for American consumers. So they're paying $1 million for every American job that they're saving. Surely there has to be a better way than that.
Of course.
An absolute nightmare when it comes in terms of costs for American consumers. There has to be a way forward that loosens that. And so we've seen a shift in the dialogue for the Democrats, which is both positive to see Biden speak like that, but then also incredibly depressing that just simply acknowledging that trade is good is something that we have to appreciate on the radio, because the conversation on trade has just gotten so negative and so poisonous over the last, let's say, 2 years.
And if Biden is not your guy, if Bernie's not your guy, maybe Warren is your woman. Let's hear what she has to say on trade.
I wasn't here. I've been in Congress long enough to have voted against NAFTA, but I led.
By the way, great dig.
Yeah.
I have not been in Congress since, you know, NAFTA. When was that? 92? 90? I mean,
long time
almost
ago.
30
long
years
time
ago.
Ago.
I haven't been in Congress for 30 years. Okay, let's start over.
I wasn't here. I've been in Congress long enough to have voted against NAFTA, but I led the fight against the trade deal with Asia and the trade deal with Europe, because I didn't think it was in the interests of the American people, the American workers, or environmental interests. But we have farmers here in Iowa who are hurting, and they are hurting because of Donald Trump's initiated trade wars. We have workers who are hurting because the agreements that have already been cut really don't have enforcement on workers' rights. This new trade deal...
All right. So much cognitive dissonance that's happening right now.
She literally said she owned herself, or self-owned, for all the people who are on Twitter who see this happen all the time. So she led the fight.
She self-deported. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. She led the fight against trade deals, and Iowa farmers are hurting because of Donald Trump's trade war. Okay. Wait a second. What is a trade war? All right, a trade war is increasing tariffs, limiting access, all of the things that she apparently is in favor for as well.
And they mentioned workers' rights. I mean, it's not as if the Iowa farmers are now being oppressed by some big bad boss. There's just so much. There's too much that she jumbles in there, and it sounds slogany. It sounds good. Let's see. She'll finish her point. Maybe she comes up with something a bit more, you know, cognizant.
Is a modest improvement. Senator Sanders himself has said so. It will give some relief to our farmers. It will give some relief to our workers. I believe we accept that relief. We try to help the people who need help. And we get up the next day and fight for a better trade deal. We need a coherent trade policy. We need a policy that actually helps our workers, our farmers. We need them at the table.
They have to stop using this image of people around a negotiating table. That's just not how it works. It's just not. It's not. You just ask labor to the table and then everything is fine.
Yeah, it's and what's hilarious is she's talking about, well, we need to help farmers. Well, we need to help farmers. Well, I can think of a policy that would help farmers. So use soybeans as an example. What's going to help those farmers? Allow for the Chinese market to buy American soybeans. They want to. They can't afford it with tariffs. And as tariffs go up, they get crowded out of the market. But there's a billion people in China who would love to buy American produce and would love to buy the agricultural products that American farmers grow, whether it's livestock or crops. So, I mean, overnight, you could be helping these farmers by just giving them access to the world. right? There's a there are 95% of the world's consumers out there.
They're out there.
Yeah, they're right there. They're waiting. And with these trade restrictions that the Bernies and the Warrens of the world want to enact, you close off the opportunities for those farmers. Yeah. They have a smaller consumer base to sell to, and nobody wins. Nobody wins in a scenario like that.
That's true. I mean, there were some articles that came out about how much the tariffs had raised. You know, there's, I don't know what it was, an additional, let's say $50 billion or something. And everyone was praising that. And it's like, that is literally the money that consumers had in their pockets that they just don't have anymore. So essentially this has just been a reimbursement racket for the government. So people are having to pay higher prices so the government can have less of a deficit and everyone can feel as if they're winning in some game. I don't know. Very atrocious. Yeah. We have to show, though, David, that we're not we don't play favorites. We're not just in favor of 70-something Democrats, 70-something aged Democrats. We also like the older millennials or Gen Xers. Actually, is Pete Buttigieg millennial? No, he's Gen Xer, I guess. Maybe he's millennial.
Yeah, he's on the cusp. He's young enough, though.
He's like elder millennial. So Pete Buttigieg, he's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and he had a little something to say on trade as well.
Mayor Buttigieg, do you support the USMCA, yes or no?
Yes, it has been improved. It is not perfect. But when you sit down with the people who are most impacted, they share just how much harm has been done to them. By things like the trade war, and just how much we can benefit American consumers and workers and farmers.
He said consumers.
Sure, we have the right kind of labor and enforceability, as Democrats ensured we got in this USMCA. But let's acknowledge why there is such fear and frustration. You know, my part of the country, in the industrial Midwest, I remember when they came around in the 90s selling trade deals, telling us, don't worry about your slice of the pie. The pie will get so much bigger that everyone will be better off. And that promise was broken. The part about the pie getting bigger happened. It's just that the part about it getting to most people where I live did not. That is why there is such frustration. The sense that these decisions in boardrooms and in committee rooms in Washington are being made not based on what's best for us, but based on their own gain.
He was going so well. The roller coaster was going up the hill and then just fell. But at the end, he kind of saved himself. Did you hear that part? Let's actually play that one more time.
Not based on what's best for us, but based on their own game.
Mayor Buttigieg. One more time. We got this.
Decisions in boardrooms and in committee rooms.
In boardrooms and committee rooms. So I like that. It's the idea that a lot of this stuff is just being decided up in Washington and you as an ordinary consumer have no say. I did like that.
Yep.
That was good. But
yeah,
why is this narrative there? Why? I mean, David, you're sitting in Canada. Is there the narrative that NAFTA was a disaster and that millions of people are worse off today than they were before?
No, certainly not. I mean, there is a very progressive left side of politics that is generally against some of these trade deals, but even the National Auto Union in Canada is in favor of trade deals. And it was one of those very unique moments in politics. And it would be the same for an American audience when you have bipartisan support for a particular endeavor. Renegotiating NAFTA became a national conversation, and virtually everybody was on board from across the political spectrum, from various industries. Everyone was on board in terms of getting a new deal done, and continuing that relatively open trade relationship with the United States. And so it was great to see so many come together in that sense. It would be nice if American politics had the same viewpoint or mantra, but it seems that we have a bit of a horseshoe where some on one side of the right and one side of the left end up being anti-trade on both sides. So you don't have that unity, where in Canada it was very common for pretty much the entirety of the political spectrum to be pro free trade and pro agreement.
Yeah, and I think for at least the debates, Again, this is one of the only debates that I even heard something positive about trade. So I was at least happy to hear a little bit there. Trade is an important thing. There'll be a lot more deals that'll be talked about. We still don't have our full USMCA. There's still so much that could be done there. We'll hear a lot more about it, but that's what we'll do here on Consumer Choice Radio. You're listening here on the Big Talker FM 106.7. One thing, David, that they mentioned in the debate, and of course would hugely impact hundreds of millions of Americans, would be healthcare. Now, there's a good number of clips that I was able to put together. You sent me some thoughts as well. You saw the, again, we don't need to rehash the same debate that everyone's been having the entire time, but figured since, Pete Buttigieg now is being considered a better candidate or is highlighted a little bit in the polls, he did get a bit more speaking time. So I wanted to play sort of his take on healthcare and what he'd like to do, because it is very central, it seems, right now to the Democratic argument over healthcare.
Well, it's making sure that there is no such thing as an uninsured American. Look, the individual mandate was an important part of the ACA because the system doesn't work if there are free riders. What I'm offering is a choice. You don't have to be in my plan if there's another plan that you would rather keep. And there's no need to kick Americans off the plans that they want in order to deliver health care for all. And my plan is paid for. Look, our party should no longer hesitate to talk about the issue of the debt and the deficit.
Oh my God, I love that. He said, our party cannot be afraid to talk about the debt and the deficit. Who is this guy? How did he get on the stage? Excuse me, Mr. Buttigieg, do your parents know where you are?
Yeah. Are you sure you're in the right place?
Yeah.
Do you belong on this stage? Yeah. No, I mean, it is nice to see someone say, okay, hold on, all of these plans are great. However, there is a bigger conversation at play here, and we got to pay for this. And we have to figure out and be honest and open about how we're going to pay for it. And if we're going to take on debt, we also have to talk about that, because obviously the United States is on the verge of a debt crisis, and adding trillions of dollars worth of debt to an already bloated system could be extremely problematic down the road.
And Elizabeth Warren is not happy with Pete Buttigieg's answers on healthcare, and she responds immediately. That's what she does, and has to try to rip apart his plan.
Look, the numbers that the mayor's offering just don't add up. The average family in America last year paid $12,000 in some combination of deductibles and co-pays and uncovered expenses and fees. You can't cover that with the kind of money that the mayor is talking about. The way we have to approach this is we've got to build this, and we've got to build the alliances to make this happen. I can bring down the cost of prescription drugs like insulin and take hundreds of millions of dollars out of the system immediately in cost. We can get help to families, but we have to be willing to work together. We can let people experience what healthcare is like when it's you and your doctor, your mental health professional, your nurse practitioner with no insurance company standing in the middle.
But the government's going to be right there holding your hand and making sure that everything goes according to plan.
And you're not going to be allowed to have the insurance plan that may better suit your needs or your own medical concerns, because private health insurance will be banned.
Yeah. And this is it's a debate that's been ongoing. Many of you might remember, if you're listening, the debates all the way back to Sarah Palin talking about what the Obama healthcare plan would do and the idea of death panels. And there's been a lot of comparison between healthcare in different countries. Bernie Sanders loves to bring up the kind of Scandinavian examples, but he's also much more partial to his neighbor to the north, Canada. And it just so happens that you, David, live there now. You pay and contribute to the system. You're a part of this system. Tell us, when you hear the plans of Elizabeth Warren, let's say, or Bernie Sanders, and they are attempting to, adopt a Canada-lite healthcare plan in the U.S., how does that sound to you? Does it sound feasible? What would it actually mean?
So, no, I it's definitely not feasible for the United States to go the route of Canada for a couple reasons. The first is that you'd have to ban private insurance, and too many Americans enjoy the choice that is involved in the particular insurance package they have. Now, health insurance is always stressful and it can be expensive, but when you poll Americans who have private insurance, the thought of that being illegal is problematic. So to go that route is a huge issue. The second issue is the scalability of the Canadian system.
Smart.
So if we actually look at other countries, if we look at Europe, which is actually more of what Mayor Pete is suggesting, if we look at Europe, all of those systems have private options and have options to kind of pay your own way. That's all prohibited in Canada. That doesn't exist.
So that's, I think, a key difference a lot of listeners need to pay attention to, because it is true in a place like Austria, where my wife is from, she's able to get private care. And a lot of times it either adds on to the public care or it can replace it altogether. But that option exists. But in a place like Ontario, that is not possible.
Yeah, it's not possible to do any type for almost everything, with the exception of like LASIK eye surgery. That's private. And there is a private hernia, sports hernia clinic. But other than that, everything is in the public system. And when everything is in the public system, yes, you may have the benefit of it being universal, but you also have the huge negative of wait times. And so something like seeing an ear, nose, and throat specialist in the greater Toronto area, I mean, you're realistically looking, you go to your family doctor, they say that you need to see a specialist, you're realistically looking at probably between 6 to 9 months before you can get into the specialist.
Wow.
I'm sure for most listeners, that sounds frightening, because that is not how the U.S. system works. And so to go that route would be incredibly problematic. And I can totally sympathize with Democrats and Republicans alike who want a universal system and want everyone to have coverage. That I totally understand that, but I don't think they should be holding the Canadian example up as one that is a desirable system to replicate. If they're going to go that route, I think there are just much better, more patient-friendly, more dynamic options and systems that are available in Europe that allow for a mixed system. They allow for private care, private insurance for those who want it. And so I definitely think that's the preferable way forward for Democrats.
Yeah. And I think we have to give praise to Buttigieg for even mentioning consumers. It's never really talked about. It's always about the agencies and the government and my plan and the trillions. And it was very, very cool to see Buttigieg get a bit feisty. So here's a clip here. I think he's responding now to Warren's response. I don't know. There's too many back and forths in these debates. It's hard to follow that. All right. Here's Buttigieg. Yeah. Here we go.
It's just not true that the plan I'm proposing is small. We got to move past a Washington mentality that suggests that the bigness of plans only consists of how many trillions of dollars they put through the Treasury.
Woo!
That the boldness of a plan only consists of how many Americans it can alienate. This would be a game changer. This would be the biggest thing we've done to American healthcare in a half century. Let's measure the effect of our plans based on what they would do in our everyday lives. And yes, we're taking on cost. On prescription drugs, we'll have an out-of-pocket cap, even if you don't get the subsidies that would make it free, a $250 monthly cap. And here's why it's got to be monthly. You ever been in that situation or known somebody who finds that they've got to defer a procedure or delay filling a prescription to try to have it happen in the right month? Because of when your out-of-pocket cap hits, it makes no sense medically, because most of us don't experience the economy on an annual basis. Our bills don't come in every year. They come in every month.
Oh, he had a great visual there that, you know, we don't experience the economy. You know, it's not like our paychecks. I love that. I don't like the idea of further meddling with the prescription drugs, because I think that'll just end up making them way more expensive and we'll have a lot less innovation. Specifically with Bernie Sanders' plan to get everything from Canada, which, by the way, is also Trump's plan. We have to recognize that, and there's plenty of articles on that. I think this at least is a way that people are talking about healthcare and Yeah, ensuring consumer choice and some kind of competition. So we got to give our props to the South Bend mayor. I guess former mayor. He's out of the job now.
Yes, yeah. Definitely props to Mayor Pete for at least viewing this with patience. And patience as consumers as a lens in terms of how the healthcare market responds and things like that, rather than only viewing it in the macro sense of, okay, how can we spend as much money as possible and put the free sticker on it, which is obviously not true or accurate, but seems to be the mantra of both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, and just to remind you, this is Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker 106.7 FM. We've put together a very good show notes list on consumerchoiceradio.com. That includes some articles by our colleagues at the Consumer Choice Center. One article that's related to what we just talked about is by our colleague, our CCC Managing Director, Fred Roda. It's time for the UK to bring drug approval into the 21st century. This is published in CapX. You can head over to our website and read that. This is all about the drug approval system and how we know when particular drugs are going to be entered into our system, and then a lot about intellectual property. There's a lot that can be done in the United Kingdom to streamline this and to mirror countries like Germany and other European countries and even Canada at times. So there's great things to come out of that. Our colleague Bill Wietz, again, has a piece out in Epicenter about a new pro-science citizens initiative. So some great stuff coming out of Europe. I think any of our listeners would be very interested in that. And then the last media hit that I've highlighted here comes from Benzinga, and this is about the Cannabis Conclave in Davos. So we're going to be broadcasting from Davos next week. We'll be in the mountains of Switzerland, and we've got a beautiful event, a beautiful venue. David, what is this all about?
Yeah, so we're returning to Davos again, our second annual Cannabis Conclave. It brings together investors, policymakers, and folks from the industry. It is officially sold out. We are at capacity. So really looking forward to that. Just picture yourself at a Swiss chalet in the mountains overlooking this beautiful city. So that is where we will be. Super excited to be broadcasting from Davos, which is quite unique for us. Hopefully get a chance to talk with some influential people to defend consumer choice, to defend market freedoms, and enjoy ourselves.
Yeah, and we might even, if the news is correct, rub shoulders with Greta Thunberg. She'll be at Davos. There's an article here in The Guardian. At Davos, we will tell world leaders to abandon the fossil fuel economy. So Greta Thunberg, that's the correct Swedish pronunciation, she'll be there. Maybe we can get her to the cannabis event. Maybe we can, you know, have a laugh up on the mountain. I don't know. She'll probably disapprove of us using Ubers and cars to get around. Who knows? But some very interesting conversations. And you can learn more about Cannabis Conclave at cannabisconclave.com. David, I have one last clip I got to play. It's an important anniversary. I don't know if you've heard of this anniversary, but it is, and we just missed it. We just missed it. It was January 17th, so technically yesterday. It was the 100th anniversary of the beginning. This was enacted by constitutional amendment. There was a huge fervor around the United States to try to pass this for years and years. It was the situation whereby the activists, the temperance movement, the anti-Saloon League, the anti-Germans, basically a huge contingent of people who just hated Germans who owned a lot of breweries, they all came together, and in a kind of multi-year, multi-layered approach, they succeeded in banning alcohol in one of the freest countries in the world. And we celebrated yesterday on January 17th, the 100th anniversary. I hope we've learned our lessons. We've learned our lessons on how bad prohibition was, not just for security when we talk about organized crime, also for health, the amount of people who are getting sick on tainted alcohol. You know, what happens when you have a large government law like this that tries to strip away people's personal freedoms and individual liberties We see what happens. There is a death toll. This actually led to entire portions of your society not caring about the laws anymore. That's where the name scofflaw came from. This is really why, in the end, it was overturned. People were so concerned that no one cared about the law anymore. There was no respect for institutions, no respect for the rule of law. Mm-hmm. It's been 100 years. I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And I think the big lesson here is the lesson that should be taken away for legislators is don't replicate these silly decisions for other substances, whether it's flavored vape pods or cannabis or whatever a particular legislator wants to ban, which that list seems to be getting longer and longer every day.
Oh, yeah.
Banning something outright, if there's consumer demand for it, does not mean that it's not going to exist.
Yeah.
And alcohol prohibition was horrific. It did nothing, nothing for consumer safety. It did nothing to benefit the criminal justice system or law enforcement, because you had the mob and all sorts of nefarious criminals profiting off of alcohol sales. And we see that for other things. And yet we haven't really reflected enough, I don't think, in terms of why it's misguided to replicate those mistakes. And so luckily there is a positive day coming forward, which will be the anniversary of when it's repealed.
And there's a great clip that I had to pull. It was from the CBS This Morning clip. And it's a good argument that's presented by an author, Lisa McGeer. She wrote a book called The War on Alcohol, Prohibition and the Rise of the American State. She actually makes the case that modern surveillance state and the modern sort of let's say governmental intrusion into our lives, not just from a policy perspective, but actually agents and people who are hired, all started with prohibition. It's really interesting. Let's listen to this.
Prohibition is the very serious and long-lasting legacies of the law.
Lisa McGeer is a history professor at Harvard University and the author of The War on Alcohol.
The 1920s saw a vast upsurge in federal power. And after 1933, that power did not diminish. It simply took on new directions. One of those directions was policing and surveillance. The prison industry vastly expanded. Mm-hmm. So many of the kind of legacies that we live with were established during Prohibition.
I mean, this is where you had your first national police force. You had these Prohibition agents that had badges and would like knock down the doors of what they thought were speakeasies. I mean, what a crazy day. But as you mentioned, David, it's not far off. We could see agents popping down the doors of vape shops pretty soon.
Yeah, especially depending on who the Democratic nominee is and if they become president. There are a couple of them who, I mean, without outright saying it, have basically described what was in that clip and what we've chatted about. But for vape stores, shut down the entire industry, arrest everyone who's selling them, confiscate and arrest people who are using them. Just an absolutely mind-boggling, ridiculous suggestion. That seems to be the soup of the day in terms of what policymakers want to ban and what they want to arrest people for.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate. Hopefully we've got a lot of lessons from this. People have been able to learn from it. And hey, you know, it's 100 years on. Hopefully we can learn a bit more about the mistakes of the past. We have opportunities to learn. That's the great thing about the kind of modern age. We have books we can read. We have radio programs like ours. These are the great media that we have available to discuss these policy issues and hopefully make a change where we can. You've been listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker FM 106.7. I'm your host, Yael Ososki, joined by my co-host, David Clement. David, it's been a great program.
Yeah, it sure has been. Thank you to all of our listeners. Thank you to everyone who has listened, given feedback, and we hope to keep you along this train as we proceed down the road. More broadcasts, more guests, and bringing you more great content.
And we want to thank Tim Andrews again of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance and the Australian Taxpayers Alliance. Some really good insight on the brush fires down in Australia. We'll have plenty more guests next week. We'll have a great live from Davos episode. We'll be in Davos, Switzerland, alongside the World Economic Forum. So much to do there. Check out our website, Consumer Choice Radio. Subscribe to the podcast if you want to listen to us later. And we can't wait to get back at the microphones. So until next time, we wish you all the best. Until next week.